Before we start, if you're enjoying these conversations, please make sure that you like or subscribe to Cleaning Up. It really helps other people to find us. Cleaning Up is brought to you by the Liebreich Foundation and the Gilardini Foundation.
Hello, I'm Michael Liebreich, and this is Cleaning Up. My guest today is Damilola Ogunbiyi. She's the CEO and also the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Sustainable Energy for All. And she's also co-chair of UN Energy. Let's bring Damilola Ogunbiyi into the conversation. Damilola, welcome to Cleaning Up. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I can almost not believe that you and I have not met, given that you run SE for All, and it was such a big part of my life for, I'm guessing, about a decade.
I think it's because of the Zoom platform, right? Because you're kind of like this rock star in everything SDGs and energy related and really championing the whole climate movement as well. So I'm just glad we can do this now and we can follow on and build on this.
Absolutely. And we're going to hopefully meet in person during the COP meetings in Glasgow, where I think both of us are going to be for at least some of the time overlapping. But I'm just amazed because obviously, you know, you were very actively involved in this, you know, energy and finance agenda in the time when we must have been at some conferences and things together. I can't believe we've not been in the same room together at some point along the way.
Yeah, I can't imagine, especially when it comes to the developing countries. I mean, and that's why I'm so excited about, you know, this new SE4 now, like the SE4 3.0. We've got such great work from Kande and Rachel Kite, and I just want to take it to kind of the next level and make sure everyone realizes just how important Sustainable Development Goal 7 is as an agenda. But more importantly, if that isn't achieved, it's going to be tough to achieve all our other SDGs and even tougher to achieve our climate goals.
Absolutely. And that was always the core thesis that I think, you know, when I first got involved, it wasn't even called SE for All. It was called something like the UN Energy Coordinating Initiative. But it was always about the Millennium Development Goals did not have energy explicitly noted. And therefore, it was just mystifying how you were going to achieve whatever it was, whether it was the poverty agenda or the, you know, getting jobs for women included in the workforce or the health agenda. How will you do that without energy? So that was absolutely at the heart of things.
I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I'm shocked that that time didn't have anything to do with energy initially. Really happy, obviously, it came into the SDGs. But what you're talking about now is what we're still going through. You know, a lot of people don't realize just how central energy is. I mean, we say it's the golden thread, but it truly is. I mean, look at what we're going through now with the pandemic. We already know that we're not getting enough vaccines to the people that need it, the last mile, but we're not talking about the fact that even when we get it there, because of the lack of cold chains and roughly only 25% of healthcare facilities in my continent, Africa, actually have constant electricity, the amount of wastage that's being caused. So a lot of people know these issues, but connecting the dots is what we're trying to say, that, you know, energy is at the heart of that. And if you give a locality or a person, or especially a woman, adequate energy, it will resolve a lot of the issues that we're having right now.
Right. Now, our audience is very diverse. What you'll find is there are some people who are, you know, incredible technocrats. They know this stuff, you know, better than I do. But also some people who, you know, dip in and they're educated. They're all very interested and very committed to the net zero transition and to the climate agenda and also to the inclusion and equity agendas, but they may not know all about sustainable energy for all. So why don't we start, and perhaps you could just say, what is this thing? Because you're also the special representative for sustainable energy for all, but you're the CEO. You know, it's all kind of like, okay, it's all good, but what is it?
Okay, so first, Sustainable Energy for All is an international organization that was born out of a UN initiative that you helped put together in your time. Its main focus, its only focus, is to achieve SDG 7, which is really, in a nutshell, affordable, sustainable, modern energy for all, by 2030. It's broken into three different sections, and the first section is actually two. First is universal access for electricity for all, of which we still have about 759 million people not having enough, no electricity at all, to be honest. So they can't do these nice things like Zoom calls that we can do. And we have 2.6 billion people who have no access to clean cooking, which is incredibly worrying as an African woman as well, knowing that about 4 million people die from using really harmful fuels every single year. For me, it's a pandemic on its own. And it's probably one of the largest causes of deforestation, at least on the continent. And then we have another target, which is to increase the share of renewables. That's been going steadily up. It's not as bad as electrification or clean cooking access. And I think we probably will achieve that goal by 2030. And then the final part is on energy efficiency, where we're trying to get to this magic 3% every year. We're not on track to achieve that at all. And so what we are, our main goal at SC for All is that we need the policy, the financing, and the just transition to be in place and people to understand just how critical this is for people and for planet. And to also understand that if we don't achieve this goal of universal access by 2030, we cannot achieve net zero by 2050. So that's what we stand for. That's what I'm doing, my entire team. And that's also what the UN stands for and the Secretary General. This year, we have the first high-level dialogue on energy in 40 years. That's a lot in most of our lifetimes, the first time, which again is a bit shocking. We have so many climate conferences, but it was the first time we had an energy, a real deep energy conversation in 40 years. So for me personally as well, and the organization, that direct link between energy and climate and understanding you cannot leave almost a billion people in energy poverty. You have to carry them on this journey. It's critical. And that's what we're doing.
Thank you very much. And you know, the good news is for those who want more details on where those three goals came from, energy access, renewables, and energy efficiency, we had Kande Yamkala. I'm going to say it was something like episode 15. It's probably not 15, but it's somewhere around then. Anybody who goes to the website and scrolls through will be able to see Kande Yamkala. And then, of course, your predecessor, the second, which you know you talked about. This is now SC for All 3.0, the reign of Ogumbi. But you have had 1.0, which was Kande Yamkala, and then 2.0 under our, I believe it was actually episode 2, Rachel Kite.
That's really interesting. And I'm just really blessed to have such amazing people kind of come before me and work in different areas. I mean, Kande worked on establishing and people understanding the real importance that energy plays, and he's still very committed to that. Rachel kind of took it to the next level in terms of international organization globally. Also recognizing the advocacy piece. That's where we started having things like our forums and all these other agendas. And now I think it's all about the decade of action. You know, we can't say we've achieved anything unless we can show it on ground. So there's just a 3.0 isn't just about the reign of Ogumbi. It's more in terms of what the actions we can do on ground and how we can really, really not just talk about not leaving people behind, absolutely focus our policies, our data-driven decision-making on helping people and governments on ground achieve these actions.
That's right. And so many of the audience listening or watching will say, well, you know, but this is actually all part of the SDG 7. And they won't really know how hard it was and how hard we worked and how hard Kande worked and then Rachel worked to make it SDG 7. It was not obvious. It could have been folded into a different SDG, but you know, we worked hard to make sure that energy had its own sustainable development goal because we were so convinced that it was absolutely integral to the achievement of pretty much everything else, and therefore it really needed that focus.
And I'm glad you really had that foresight, because a lot of people didn't realize, again, coming from a developing country, that energy is our climate action. Do you see what I mean? Like being able to have sustainable energy, but to be clean, that is really our, you know, energy transition. If you think about just think about sub-Saharan Africa. If you take away South Africa, there's only about 81 gigawatts of energy installed. You know, that means that that region is already energy poor. And we're not having conversations on this needs to be 10x to get people out of poverty and make sure it's clean. Everyone's having conversations how you reduce energy. And that's what the beauty about SDG 7, it makes us highlight the key issues that, yeah, why we're where we should focus on energy transition and moving away from very harmful fuels into clean fuels. We can't forget that in some regions in the world, especially Asia and Africa, more energy is going to be needed. Populations are growing, and we have to make sure that we have the tools, but more importantly, the financing to make sure that energy that's needed is done in a clean, sustainable way. Instead of reverting back to what we do as business as usual, and then in 20 years' time, coming back to transition there. And I think that's what's just so exciting for me, being able to create a platform where, you know, you're starting at such a low base, and being able to really, really influence decisions that affects us all, you know, over the next few decades.
Absolutely. And let's come back in a minute to this particular moment in time. We're recording this a couple of weeks before COP26 in Glasgow. Glasgow ought to move this agenda forwards. In fact, what you may not know is that the last episode, that, in fact, it's just come out this week, of Cleaning Up was with Alain Ebobissé, who's the CEO of Africa 50, the infrastructure fund. And I had the same conversation with him about how, in a sense, everybody, you know, we're sitting here in the developed world talking about, wouldn't it be nice to have, you know, clean energy and net zero and 2050 and so on. But actually, in much of Africa, the question is, how do you actually get on that ladder in the first place and get energy? Can we just look at how we're doing? Because you talked about, you gave the statistics. You said 759 million people without electricity. And for context, when I started to work on the UN Energy Initiative, or coordinating initiative as it was then, the number was 1.4 billion. So, you know, I'm not going to take the win, because it's not a win. But we're definitely on that one. It feels like, particularly with all these sort of rooftop systems and microgrids, plus building out the grid, that that's been quite good progress. But the scary one, the one that you mentioned, is 2.6 billion people still cooking, or their family is still cooking, using wood, charcoal, animal dung, and suffering terrible health consequences. If you touch on those two, you know, how do we get the rest of people to get electricity? And then what do we do? What are the actual technical solutions for the cooking challenge?
So first, yes, electrification might look like it's getting better. But most of those wins have really been in a couple of countries, you know, and that's all in South Asia. So South Asia has done amazing. India, amazing in terms of what it's managed to achieve. But it's not like there's an even split. And what we're finding now, because we don't have the stats since COVID, everything we're working on is still 2019 figures, is with 150 million people going back to extreme poverty. You can imagine most of them are also going to go back into electricity poverty. In terms of clean cooking, it's just more bleak. You know, it's a key cause of not only women having to spend 5 hours a day just on this task of cooking, but it's also a very large cause of gender-based violence. So it's really disturbing stats when you look at it that way. In terms of the solutions, I'm a very big data geek. Everything I've done to all my career from Nigeria till now has been based on data-driven decision-making. And I feel we first have to give the tools to countries to understand what is their energy mix and who has electricity, who doesn't, who has clean cooking, who doesn't. And it might sound very basic to us sitting in the developed world, but it's critical, right? Because it's a whole of government change we're asking for. We're asking for countries to electrify the entire economy, something that hasn't been done anywhere else, but we're asking people with the least amount of money to do that. Okay, so how exactly does that fit into the larger energy transition plan? So I'm very, very keen on let's move pledges to actions. So if I pledge net zero by 2050, what does that mean for my economy? And a study that's happened in my country with with thanks to the UK COP Unit Energy Transition Council, which I co-chair, is that the Nigerian energy transition plan, obviously being complex because it's such a large oil and gas nation, is that, you know, Nigeria itself needs something on the regions of $410 billion above business as usual spending just to get anywhere near net zero. So I just want to give you an idea of the scale of what we're asking these countries to do. But, you know, if we are really serious about it, the financing has to come in place. So I spoke about the data and the platforms, I mean, the financing, and then obviously the policy and the regulation. Most countries around the world, policy actually is driven by projects. You don't have to wait till the perfect policy to drive things in place. So those are kind of the three key things that I feel that for clean cooking and electrification that we should make sure we push forward. But also understanding, I guess, so the three key, but I guess the final and more important thing, global political will to solve this issue, to treat what is happening to millions of people, somehow billions of people, as an injustice. It's not equality, and to treat it as a pandemic on its own and come together and say, look, we want to solve this issue. Because if we solve this issue, there'll be more economic growth, there'll be healthier people. There's such a range of things that can happen by resolving this. And that's what we're trying to kind of push at COP, right? That while we recognize the big emitters and everything that's going on, don't forget that these countries could become big emitters if you don't consider them now, if they're not part of your plans moving forward. And that's obviously very important to us as an organization and the United Nations itself, but it should be important to everybody. People shouldn't be okay with the people not having clean energy, life and death for a lot of people. And, you know, there were a few hundred millions of people that can't stay at home when there's a key pandemic, unless they will die of hunger. So everything ties together. And I feel like we're at a tipping point where, like, key decisions that we need to make globally and really take it seriously. And again, I cannot stress the finance enough. We're still struggling with the 100 billion. And this is something that's been committed how many years ago. We really need to put we really need to make actions known, and we need to put our money behind things that are for the global good.
Absolutely agree. That's a very eloquent sort of listing of the, in a sense, the policy, the political, the geopolitical, and also the moral case and the moral kind of checklist of things that just have to happen. I was after before then, what do the solutions look like? And maybe if we can just take electrification,
electrification,
but what does it, what does it actually look like? Look, there's a question. Is electrification all about it has to be the grid, or can it be rooftop? Can it be microgrids? Is that going to meet the needs, or are we just, because I tell you what, the last thing that I want to do is impose some solution. I'm a middle-aged, middle-class white guy. I'm not going to be able to tell anybody that they should just be happy with a solar roof. But if they tell me that would be fine, because then the kids can study and that's good for the rural area, as long as the clinic gets some, what does success on electrification look like? And then I want to get on to the cooking.
Okay, so, I mean, if we're going down to the technologies, again, this is where the data comes in. It's important to have integrated energy planning. And what that does is it allows you to plan the least cost way of providing adequate and sustainable electrification for your population. So in a standard integrated energy plan, what I would want to see is how many people should be connected to the grid, how many people should be connected to decentralized energy, either through mini grids or solar standalone systems, and how many people should just be simply off-grid with the mixture of conventional energy and renewable systems in a kind of like a CNI type of approach. I'm of the opinion, I'm not against mini solar solutions like solar lanterns. I just don't think that's electrification. I think it does play a role in terms of providing light for some critical things like education, for herdsmen, that all these things you can talk about. But I think the fundamental and where people tend to get it wrong is not understanding, one, what people need to thrive and be, and have some type of economic growth in this scenario. Two, where you should be providing power. And I'll give you an example of this. In my previous role, all I was doing was providing power to communities and markets and hospitals. So I know this quite well. And I remember going into some communities and they would say, could you provide us power where we work instead of where we live? And I was a bit baffled. And they were like, that's where we're productive. That's where we are for 16 to 18 hours a day. If I can have some additional income from there, I will sort out my house. Like, don't worry about it. So it's very, very important to understand that when we talk about energy, it's not the minimum tier zero, tier one, it's energy for development, energy for economic growth. Like there's a budding tech industry now with young entrepreneurs in Africa. Are we going to power a whole server room? You know what I mean? With just a, you know, solar lantern? No, we're not, you know, but can it be a hybrid system? Of course it can be. You know, this is where a lot of battery storage is going to come in now. I do not believe that we should be doing any solar hybrid systems without adequate battery storage. That's another thing that I've always been championing, because it can't be solar for solar hours. It needs to be, if you're saying about solar hybrid technology, it needs to be for the full time. So I think that counts as the electrification part. For the clean cooking part, it's a little bit more difficult, right? Because the fuel source is free. People are not used to paying for what they use. So I think we are going to go through different energy transitions, right? What suits a person could be electrification. I doubt it if you have no clean cooking initially, but if you could tie it into some type of solar solution for your house, that might be able to work. And there's lots and lots of studies. There's a really, really great thing with MEX going on right now on how to bring those costs down and the equipment costs down. There's also, you know, what people think is controversial, which is the use of LPG. In terms of LPG cylinders, in terms of moving forward. Again, if I had to have a choice between a woman not having any energy at all or using an LPG, I would obviously choose LPG. What we have to realize, and this is why I'm talking about the policy, you can't really take the technology away from the policy, is how do you transition out of that? Do you see? Everything that we're doing has to be transitionary. What a lot of African leaders are upset about is they feel that they're not allowed to actually undertake a just transition. They feel that even though everywhere around the world are using transitionary fuels to net zero, they are told to stop now. And it's just very, very difficult. And because we don't have like that template, right, of people in the developed world that don't have that much money trying to do this transition, and countries with all the money not even getting it right, it gives a lot of tension. So my whole thing is that we have to make allowance for transitionary fuels as long as it's part of a plan to net zero. So I'm never hooked up on fossil or no fossil. I know it seems very controversial. I'm more on terms of how, whatever you're going to put in place, how does it allow you to still get to net zero? I believe there is that world where we can come up with a synergy for people and for planet. We don't have to choose one or the other. Because again, being from sub-Saharan Africa, if you look at global emissions, again, if you take away South Africa, you're talking about 0.55% of global emissions currently going on. What are there to decarbonize right now? You know, that is my sense of it. But we have to make sure that the low carbon trajectory is maintained. But it's not done in a way that stops development.
Right. And these are such important messages because, you know, I have my, you know, sort of media activities, and I'm on Twitter a lot and LinkedIn, and I do my speaking. And, you know, you get so many people who say things like, well, obviously nuclear is the answer. And it's like, have you thought about Niger or Ethiopia or Gabon? And you're really suggesting that? And other people saying, oh, well, they should just go to electric cooking. It's like, what, ceramic hobs? Mm-hmm. You know, do you know how much one of those costs? And where's the electricity? You're not going to do a ceramic pot, the hob, with, you know, power from the roof of some, you know, some part. And it's not going to be that person's top priority. And then you have other people saying, oh, well, you must leave your gas in the ground. And this is something that, you know, I talked to Alain Eboubissé about. that we're using gas, we're keeping the lights on now in Europe because we've got gas. But then you have people who are saying, oh, no, Africa mustn't develop its gas. That would be very bad because of the climate. And I think it is this, it is so important to move fast. But ultimately, it will also be so important to have a pathway to net zero, yeah. Whether it's 2050, frankly, or 2060 or 2070, in my mind. And there'll be people, you know, emailing and going crazy on social media because I say this. But in my mind, you know, if sub-Saharan Africa can be, you know, wealthy, developed, and then rich enough to afford all those ceramic hobs for every single, you know, woman and man cooking by 2070, I'll take that as a win, to be quite honest. I don't know whether you'd agree.
Yeah, people will be going mad on Twitter. I am of opinion, especially since I've been on ground and I see the suffering that even the COVID has caused in my countries and, you know, people that had electrification, some developers have just shut down. Things have just happened that I'm just a lot more practical, right? And again, I've seen how, you know, one of my first projects was providing power to healthcare facilities. And I was very ignorant. I just came straight from London thinking, oh, let me get my KPI sheet down. And, you know, people were telling me that you save babies' lives, right? I just don't think we can be so purist about it when people's lives are at stake. And I would always share this sentiment. And I feel that this is where there needs to be a closer alignment between the climate world and the energy world. And people just need to be truthful about the evidence, right? And it's not okay. It's not okay because Africa is low emitting to leave Africa as it is, right? That's a cop out. It's really, really not okay. And again, it's not okay to say Africa doesn't have the right to have a just and equitable transition as well. But we do have to watch it. We do have to make sure that it's part of a bigger plan and their focus needs to be net zero. But we are really good times. This is the first time, at least in my life, that, you know, leaders are coming to me and saying, I want to be cleaner and greener. How do I do it? What I think the problem is we don't have the response.
Yeah, let's come on to finance in a second, but I want to ask, because you mentioned healthcare a couple of times, and I did a project in Sierra Leone, in Bo. There was a neonatal unit where it was set up by this brilliant Irish doctor, Dr. Niall Conroy, working with the hospital in Bo, which is, I think you probably know, is the second city or the second or third city in Sierra Leone. And it was just a complete, by chance, I saw a tweet by Dr. Conroy saying that they had another power cut that night and I think two or three babies passed away. It should not happen in the current world. And I was actually on my way to, you know, yet another climate and energy posh dinner. And I was like, right, it should not happen. And so we did do this project and we worked with Dr. Conroy, worked with the local stakeholders, and we got this project. But it has been really complicated by, you know, all of the things that you'd expect, the, you know, bureaucracy, uncertainty over import duties, lack of technical skills, you know, UNICEF just suddenly giving the hospital more equipment, which they plugged in and everything went bang. You know, everything that could have gone wrong in a way has gone wrong. And in fact, right now, we are waiting until, you know, we can, because of COVID, we actually have to replace the batteries. So it's been really complex, lots of fabulous amounts of learning. And we have along the way saved a lot of lives, but not enough. But what are you doing initiatives now in things like healthcare? Have you got a sort of specific work stream on healthcare and education and, I don't know, SMEs and food processing? Have you gotten down? Because it feels to me like one of the trends in this space is moving away from just, I think you said, you know, having a KPI and a metric saying how many kilowatt hours have we delivered, but actually moving towards solutions. Have we packaged energy in such a way that we've solved problem X, maybe one of the other SDGs?
I mean, we have a big program on powering healthcare right now with Power Africa, actually. It all spun off. I mean, I always wanted to do something in healthcare, but with the with the pandemic, it just made it a little bit more possible. But we're not only looking at just connecting sustainable energy to healthcare facilities. We're looking at what should be the model in terms of keeping the lights on, right? So when you get to year four, if you're using lead acid batteries, or you get to year 10 when you're using lithium batteries, who replaces them, right? We know the panels will last for 25 years. What is the maintenance strategy? Who pays for it? How do you get local stakeholders? How do you get governments in? Do you tie it into a bigger mini grid for that community? Would that make it easier? And then you take a subset of that so the health center doesn't even have to pay at all. So there's so much modeling. I'm really excited about this piece of work. We started off a couple of months ago. And the thing is just to create a model which will change. I mean, it even in my country, it changes if you're going to Northern Nigeria to Southern Nigeria. And I'm glad you've been through it so you understand the complexities, because what we have to do is demystify those complexities, but to also make sure that when people say they're going to do something, they actually do it. In my experience, unfortunately, even with the technical advisor support, and you know, I was running the largest energy access program in Africa. It was $500 million. You know, sometimes it doesn't come about for 2 years. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't materialize. They do mission after mission, all these other things. So I do think our role is also holding people responsible for what they say they're going to do. I mean, if we can't do that at the United Nations, I don't know who else can do that. And that's why we're getting companies and organizations and countries and private sector to sign up to energy compacts and say, what actions, not pledges, are you going to do between now and 2030 to make sure we achieve these goals? But for health centers, I mean, again, I mean, I've probably done the most health centers I can think of in West Africa. And, you know, because we used really, really great equipment, they were a bit lower maintenance, but that's not going to always happen. And it's, for me, primary healthcare is just key because it affects babies. I don't think there could be any job I could have in the world better than saving a baby's life. And I truly, truly believe in that. And just, again, but that takes a lot of empathy and people just caring, you know, and people just seeing, because it's not a lot of money. It's not a lot of money. But if you, again, it depends, you know, like I said, Nigeria needs over 400 billion for the energy transition plan. It's a slight difference if someone goes, this is how you're going to get to 100 billion, or someone goes, oh, here's $250,000 for technical assistance. It's a different level of who you talk to in government and different level of implementation. So those are the type of things we need to understand. We need to have the projects you're doing to scale times 100 in the same region in the same country. And Sierra Leone is quite interesting because we work a lot there. Instead of just these little pockets of stuff and aid and development that doesn't really, really push the needle, unfortunately.
No, you're right. I mean, it is humbling. I raised, I think we raised about £100,000. And, you know, you are talking about potentially saving dozens of lives per year for what a such modest amount in the grand scheme of things. But then, you know, it is now a question of continuing to invest. And by the way, you know, one of the things that we learned on that one was suppressed demand matters. As soon as we upgraded the energy service and the outcomes for the babies were better, then they started to get more demand.
About 59% more inpatients when they give regular electricity. And that's where the data comes in, you know.
We started with no data. We didn't know how often there were power cuts in that hospital. So we had, you know, it was just ferociously complex, I will say.
But you actually were dedicated to doing something. And please don't underestimate that.
I'm not done yet because we still need to replace those batteries.
But you focused, and we're talking about equipment and implementation. And we're not talking about a piece of paper. And that's where we need, and you're relatively small compared to sovereigns. And that's where we need to get everybody else to.
Can I challenge you though also on one thing? When you said you need people to move beyond the pledges, and what I want to ask also is that not also true for the local players? I mean, if I look at the complexities of the little project that I did, then I would say, you know, yes, there were challenges that were coming from, you know, finding the right installers and so, you know, raising the money, making sure that there was continuity of funds for maintenance, those sorts of things. But a lot of the complexities actually came from institutional structures, I don't want to call them weaknesses, they just are what they are, but, you know, changes in health ministry, nobody being able to pledge to be committed to not charging import duty on batteries, which is a local, you know, local matter. The, you know, some of the rivalries or complexities around, you know, where does the hospital stop and the health ministry start? Also up to the local players to say, we will fix what we can fix. And then you have to provide what you morally, financially, et cetera, obligated to provide.
I completely agree. Absolutely. But then, So absolutely, completely agree. And this is a challenge locally as well. And this is not just a developing country challenge. This would also be a challenge if I wanted to do something in London. So I just wanted to first point out, like, who do you go to? Who do you talk to? I think the problem with Africa is everybody wants to go to the ministry or the agencies because there's no roadmap on who to go to first. And this is where we're talking about policy here, because the institutional capability, like before I got to the REA, there wasn't one in Nigeria, Rural Electrification Agency. Sorry, I'm not trying to use acronyms all the time. There wasn't one institution that you would go to for this. People need to realize that these countries are in their nascent form of just renewable energy, and it will take time, and it would be lessons learned from your type of program, you know, moving forward. But are you going to get import duties thrown away for one health center, if I'm getting perfect wrong? No. You know what I mean? But if you show that you're going to do proud for 100 health centers, then maybe you'd have a more policy-wide discussion. We go through this all the time with VAT for panels, you know, even fuel subsidies to make sure renewables, and that's going to be a continuous issue. But again, if you had that knowledge before, foresight, like, okay, I'm going to just price this in already because this is going to be an issue, and think that's what we're trying to do. Like, know all the issues beforehand. We're going to, obviously we work with the countries to try and solve that, but if it's not solvable, does it totally stop your project or do you have to move on? I think that's also very important. And again, it goes both ways. The locals, definitely, trust me, I was a local, so I understand that. But also when you're dealing with big institutions, I know we said we're going to finance, but I know we don't have that much time left. Like the DFIs, like the MDBs, there's not a checklist they provide you before. You know, there's not a, you have to do this. It just changes at different stages. Yeah. So I think both ways, we need to get our things sorted out. And again, another plea from the African side, that the reason why a lot of programs have worked in developed countries is because they have clear institutions that usually the politics cannot, you know, interfere with the institutional framework, the permanent secretaries, all these type of things. A lot of these institutions in Africa are barely 30, 40 years old, right? So it's a continuous evolution. And I'm not going to lie to you and say, oh, we're going to get it right by this date, right? But there needs to be a continuous evolution, continuous training, continuous learning, and just not having this assumption, which a lot of people, like, they don't know what they're doing. Right? It's just that one, they're not as resourced as everybody else. And two, it's kind of like a turf war as well, because the politics involved is also very, very real. These are 4-year terms and they want to see something happening now. So that is my plea for anybody wanting to do projects in Africa, especially healthcare. And if you have any main issues, please let me know so I can try and resolve them.
Well, that's great. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that, you know, hopefully does happen during, you know, COP26 or COP27 or COP28. And that's why all these meetings are so vital, because it does feel like, you know, there are opportunities to kind of, you know, debug some of these processes, not case by case, where you go from one hospital to the health minister, who then talks to the finance minister, who talks to the customs. Who then says, yes. You know, it must be possible to operate. And I hear you. I think that as soon as you say, oh, that's happening because they don't know what they're doing, mm-hmm. they haven't understood the local conditions. Mm-hmm. But still, maybe we can help on some of that. I want to just flip to one other thing. And again, it came up in the conversation last week with Alain Ebobise of Africa 50. Do you have a view on, we've talked about natural gas and on how this transition That you know, some people would say Africa shouldn't be doing natural gas or Southeast Asia or whatever. What do you say to all of these, this sort of frantic activity around sustainable finance and net zero finance? And people are now, you know, being all holier than thou. We don't finance all of that. We don't do that. What do you say? Do you say, well, hold your horses. Actually, you should be ring fencing out certain types of projects or certain countries? Or do you say, well, you know, that's the way the world is and we move on and we're just going to have to do this without natural gas? I mean, what do you do?
I think it's fundamentally incorrect for one country to tell another country how to develop their energy transition. So that's firstly. And I think it's also unfair that the victim of climate change, which is normally Africa and Asia, are being dictated on where the people causing climate change are still using those fuels. So those are, that's first one of my fundamental points. I think it's fine to have sustainable financing mechanisms as long as you recognize that you also need to finance developmental agendas. And some of them might be using some form of gas, as like I said, in terms of clean cooking. I question the holier than thou anyway, as in, what are you going to finance? You know, I do feel like, yeah, I want to work climate friendly things, but yeah, if you're stopping kerosene or stopping deforestation because you're using LPG, I will argue that is climate friendly. I just feel like people, again, it goes back to data, people are not spending the time, or maybe they don't want to spend the time understanding the data, and showing the data is showing that you can still achieve a lot of these targets. It's the same thing with baseload, right? Until we get these great hydrogen solutions, which hopefully we will get, and battery storage, you know, coming down to levels where we can have it backing up, you know, major grids in a cost-effective way, you know, the data shows that we don't even have enough natural gas to be able to integrate the renewables that's needed in Africa, full stop.
But I'm going to push, you know, what do you say then to an actor? You could have a bank that says, right, we're going to do natural gas because it will enable a very substantial amount of wind and solar to be done. There's fabulous wind and solar resources across Africa, but to keep the lights on, we are also going to finance natural gas that is used when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. And a bank doing that could quite easily find its windows smashed and its and people glued to its doors, activists. What do you say to those activists? They're doing it out of the best motives, but are they actually helping or not helping?
I try and educate them on just how bad things are on ground. I find a lot of activists that are thinking we could, all of us, not just Africa, switch off today, maybe don't understand the circumstances. And that's the best I can do, is continuously educate. But what I'm not going to do is say, because I do believe in net zero, that yes, it's a path that you can definitely take. You can just stop using all gas anywhere and achieve your targets, because I fundamentally don't believe it. I think you can use the natural resources the continent actually has to enable this net zero pathway that we need to get to. And, you know, the science needs to prove it, but I am not going to say it's okay for people to live in poverty a day more than they ever have to, because you don't have the views on the fuel sources. I honestly really truly believe that there is a pathway for planet and people to get us there. And I think there's been so much focus on the planet, especially in developing countries, and not enough focus on the people. And this has always happened. This is not a new thing for the African and Asian continent. We just need to make sure that this time we're not left behind.
Right. And I'm not going to do, you know, because the other one is, of course, coal, where, you know, I could do the same, you have the same question, because I think, but that one just feels like it's answered itself in the last decade, because actually the costs don't make sense. And you see things like Medupi and you're like, okay, we don't need to go there. We don't need to demand the right to do coal, because we don't want to do coal anyway. But gas seems really real. And I wonder if the solution is for those countries that want gas to work with, you know, all stakeholders, also in the developed world, to create that sort of pathway that says, look, we are committed to net zero 2060, 2070, whatever, choose a year. And therefore, if we do get finance to do some gas, it doesn't mean we're ignoring our own common but differentiated responsibilities. It just means we're on a pathway that's going to do this, but at least it's clear what the end goal is. Is that a realistic sort of communications, well, an analytical and communications exercise, or are we just destined to
I think it's something
this kind of culture wars around gas in the developing world?
I think it's something that developing countries have always done. I think people are just not listening. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to even come from a developed country into this platform. There just needs to stop this sense of arrogance that I'm in the developed world and I know best. And this is including myself. We really, really need to understand what people in developing countries that still have increasing populations at an alarming rate are truly going through. And I feel like if people want to understand that message, this conversation we're having is much easier. But instead, a lot of people not from the developing countries just make and say, okay, we have to stop this now. And I would really be okay with that if the developed world also did that, but they don't. And we've seen in the last 2 or 3 weeks how people have reverted back on their fossil policies, which would have been, you know, there'll be sanctions if the developing countries do that. So it's, how do we make this equitable? How do we make sure it is actually just, you know, everybody's transition plan is going to be different country to country, but we don't seem to be focusing on the overall goal and then working backwards on how we achieve it. We're just working and saying, if we stop now and we keep people in poverty, it's okay. And I honestly feel that there's a way to do both. And that's what we're championing.
Let's turn to finance. I threatened that we would do that. Let's talk about finance, because I was back in the days before SDG 7 was SDG 7. I was positioned, and you know, Kande Yamkele talks about this in his episode of Cleaning Up. I was kind of the finance guy who bothered, because not only did not everybody do it, but almost nobody else did it, to actually come along on the journey and try and share some knowledge and then bring in others. And then there were others that did come. So there was people like Chuck Holliday from Bank of America at the time, chair of Bank of America, was also a huge help along the way. But that finance, you talked about the 100 billion, and that came out of the so-called Copenhagen commitment to get to 100 billion per year of funding from the developed world to the global south, to the developing world. And it reached by 2019, it reached something around 80 billion. And I guess I worry about COP26, that there'll be this huge focus on, was it 80 or was it 90? And now there's been another repledge to get it to 100. And you're talking about what are fundamentally now, I hate to say it, small numbers, because the developing world needs half a trillion a year or a trillion a year or something really to catch up. The number needs to be just vastly bigger. And I need to turn that into a question. I mean, I suppose the question would be, whilst I understand, do you agree with that analysis that we should not move on and just accept that the 100 billion didn't happen, but that fundamentally we need to be focusing on what happens next and to get that 100 billion vastly bigger? And if you agree with that, how do you do that? Is it investment? Is it aid? Is it private? Is it government? How do you see that resolving at the scale that is needed?
Well, obviously it has to get up. But I think I would even take the 100 billion at this point. But a full breakdown of the 100 billion, exactly where it's going to. Obviously, that's not all going to energy. But so countries can actually see, when we even have 80 billion, how did that implement and what are the projects it actually went to. I do think that there's some catalytic projects that bring more investment as you keep going, but you know, it depends on how you fund it. In terms of the larger amounts that are needed for energy and just climate in general, it's going to be blended, isn't it? It's going to be grants, it's going to be concessionary financing, it's going to be private sector. But the private sector, at least in the African context, is not primed for Africa, right? So all of these sustainable financing packages, right, we're talking about are for people in emerging economies, right, or established economies. So what do we do in between then? Those are the questions I ask myself, right? Like, you know, how do you make sure 750 million people have access to electricity? That's really a 40 billion a year problem if that was your only focus, right? In some strategic areas and creating a lane for the private sector to really come in and operate and maintain a lot of these systems you put in place, the entrepreneur, and this will catalyze God knows how much money and how much economic growth into those countries, especially if we think about productive use and some other things. It's how to utilize every bit of money you have is where I would take it. I would take anything at this point in terms of, and I would be able to showcase if you focus on these three economies, how you break it down, what you put it into. I think what is a bit vague, especially in the energy world, is when people make targets that even private sector, we want to support 100 million connections. How? What are you going to do? What do you need to get there? Then you go to the next conference and people are saying the same thing. And that's where we're really wanting to step in. And how do we make sure all your commitments are actually to emerging economies and developed countries that would have reached those renewable targets anyway, right? Do you actually have a specific focus? And for that, it has to be a lot more government spending, a lot more concessionary finance, a lot more grant financing. We don't have the scalability in a lot of countries right now that doesn't need some level of subsidy to really, really support large scale renewables. I hope that changes the next 5-10 years, but it is where we are right now. But there's some interesting models. I mean, I'm working with the Rockefeller and IKEA team on the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet. You know, it does change the landscape if you have $2 billion of grant funding, you know, that can be aligned with the energy access and energy transition story. I have never recalled that kind of amount going into this sector before. So how do you utilize that to get a lot more money in? I mean, that would literally be my key focus for the next year after COP and pinpointing countries, because, you know, it's also leading by example, right? So if you do something in Senegal, it's most likely all the other Francophone countries who want to do something similar. It helps. It helps, you know, with the messaging. And it helps move forward. But we really need large sums of money just to even get government excited, just to get them to do stuff you're doing, ease of doing business, easier policy decisions, getting the right people in place. I'm always sharing the story, but it's really important. When we took up this challenge in Nigeria, I employed 20 to 25 of the cleverest Nigerian people, and I forced them all to move to Nigeria with me to solve this problem over a 5-10 year period. That's what it took us. Right. And but does it have to take every single country that we're really lucky we went to the best universities and we all came back? But how many countries have that, you know, and have, you know, and should they have that before they do an energy access program? So we really need to be fundamental thinking, like, what we even ask for some of these countries, is it necessary if your focus is on helping? You know, in the first place, there's a lot to go in through. And again, I don't like generalizing. So I don't like saying Africa and all these things. The specific countries that will make the overall impact, maybe like 5 or 6 of them that will solve half of these problems that we're talking about. We should focus on them and getting them right. Funding, policy, and data in those countries.
Well, I love that anecdote about how you got started in Nigeria, because I will say, from my knowledge of London and other great cities, there is not an African country that doesn't have an incredibly brilliant diaspora that somehow maybe could be persuaded to come go back and work on these issues. By the way, just about the 80 billion figure, just a note on that, it's OECD numbers. What we'll do is we'll put a link to that sort of thing in the show notes so that the the audience can follow that up and see where the numbers are and which projects have been, because that figure of 80 billion, you're right, it's not just energy, it's right across climate solutions, and it's public and private, and the OECD updates it from time to time. And you know, hopefully, perhaps not by 2020, but hopefully by 2021 or 2022, the figures will be the promised 100 billion. I guess I do worry, I will be honest, you know, you talked about the electricity access. I think you said it's $40 billion a year that needs to be invested through till 2030, presumably. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, 45 billion, sorry, including.
Okay. 45 billion. And I do worry, though, about a model that says this is investment by the developed world in developing world countries, because investment has a very specific meaning that you have to pay it back. You have to pay some kind of a yield and you have to pay the money back. And 45 billion, 10 years of that, so that's $500 billion. And then how do those countries and those people pay back, even if half of it is concessionary, half of it is aid and grants and whatever, even half of that, paying it back at 3-5%. I mean, you're talking about, are you not going to create tens of billions of dollars a year of liabilities that have to be met somehow from the, you know, by, you know, you'll bring people into productive, you know, life and productive work, and hopefully there'll be some tax base at the end of that so that the country can try to reimburse. But those are some very big numbers, you know, $500 billion. Let's say there's a 200 billion of that being commercial investment at, I don't know, 5%. That's still, I think that comes to 10 billion a year that those countries have to pay back.
First, it depends on which country. So let me dimension it. But I think there's also, people don't really understand just how much people are paying for not having adequate energy right now. You know, like if I go to Nigeria, people are probably paying 3-4 times what I'm paying in New York on my electricity bill for unreliable, depending on which part of the country. So some people are already paying, right? There's some models now that we see with CNI solar and some parts of the mini grid sector that don't even need subsidy. And I'm talking about the SMEs. Everyone seems to have a little diesel or petrol generating set. They change it every 2 years, they move it. And if you calculate a lot of the CapEx, so there's, when I talk about investment can go into certain sectors, you know, that you know that can pay for it. But I can't dimension on a regional basis how that would work. But what I know we need to do is dimension on a country-to-country local basis. The same solutions for a monster like Nigeria would not be the same from Sierra Leone, right? Right. But once we get that local difference, we can then add it all up. Right now is we have all these amazing regional plans, even my figures, 45 billion, it might even include parts of Latin America in there. But what I'm trying to say, can we get a bit more granular, you know, to the actual detail, to the economic makeup of these people, not just to willingness to pay, but affordability to pay, with some really cool AI stuff that can come out right now. What is the financial inclusion models? How do we tie this into other things? That's where we have to get to. And that's when we will truly know the figure and truly know how to split that financing.
That's just so fascinating, because in 2013, I think it was, I was challenged to write an alternative energy plan for Rwanda, because I saw the official energy plan, which was essentially for natural gas, a bit of geothermal and peat. And I thought, you cannot be serious digging up peat. And it was based on a solar price of something like 35 US cents per kilowatt hour, which was just wrong. Mm-hmm. So I wrote an alternative plan pro bono. And the challenge was, in fact, it could have gone, Rwanda has gone very, very fast in electrification, which is what we said it could do. Mm-hmm. But what was fascinating was it required something like $5-7 billion, and it's a small country compared to Nigeria or some of the more populous countries. It required $5-7 billion up front. And the only way to fund it was to hope that it would become more productive and then be able to pay that money back in 10, 15, 20 years. And that's really the, you know, you have to, there's an act of faith there that this will work, that by bringing these energy services, people will become more productive, whichever, whether it's a Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Nigeria.
But we're seeing it now. I think that's the difference, right? Like the data is actually showing it finally. And we're seeing results that we would never have hoped for. Yeah. Like I didn't think about it. I always used to focus on the energy bit, but I realized a lot of the developers coming out of Nigeria that are supporting the SME market, they're actually tech guys. They actually just see energy as a service. They're selling so many other things to these consumers. And I mean, and that's the beauty about energy, really pushing the boundaries of innovation. They're selling micro pensions, micro insurances, and they just want that kind of catchment area. You know, we're seeing just how effective gender is now in renewable jobs. And yeah, I think it's a fantastic time. And in 10 years time, we'll be having a completely different conversation because we won't even have seen all the other innovations that will be coming out from providing access to people.
That's fantastic because, you know, we've gone full circle because what you've just said is, you know, in some way, energy is the red thread that draws together all of the other sustainable development goals and all of the goals of human progress in these regions, which absolutely fully deserve to catch up with their peers in the developed world. I mean, you've just taken us straight back to the origins of SE for All, and it's been an absolutely extraordinary and great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks or a few days now. And just great work trying to get a lot of this messaging out. We really need people like you who not only understand what's happening in these countries, but can also communicate it to audiences that we might not be able to reach.
Well, thank you very much. And indeed, I do look forward to seeing you in COP. I'm hoping that I can get you involved in some of the things I'm doing. I also look forward perhaps to being invited to, whether it's at COP or subsequently, continue to help with Sustainable Energy for All and with SDG 7. But thank you so, so much for joining me here today on Cleaning Up.
Thank you so much, Michael. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Damilola Ogunbiyi, CEO and also UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Sustainable Energy for All.